Next Friday will mark a year since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, 12 months of this David and Goliath battle that has ravaged Ukraine's infrastructure, but not its resolve to drive out Vladimir Putin's troops. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Few observers on the eve of the invasion would have predicted Ukraine could hold its own for so long against a much larger army, although Ukraine has relied heavily on support from the U.S. and other allies. So what form should that support take as the conflict moves into its second year? David J. Kramer joins us to talk about this. He is executive director of the George W. Bush Institute, and you can find the organization's recommendations for U.S. support of Ukraine online at bushcenter.org. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks very much, Chris. Great to be with you.
So you and I last spoke about this just over a year ago when, you know, lots of people were concerned about a possible invasion of Ukraine, although I suppose at the time we spoke, only Russia knew for certain what was about to happen. Is there anything about the course of events in Ukraine this past year that has come as a surprise to you?
I think the surprise has been for the Russians, perhaps most notably, and that is they grossly underestimated Ukraine's ability to fight back, to resist, and to, in fact, take ground from the Russians. They grossly overestimated their own military's capabilities to win this battle, and they underestimated Ukraine's ability to withstand efforts to remove the government. President Zelensky has done a heroic job in leading Ukraine's resistance to the Russian invasion. He famously said when offered evacuation by the United States that he didn't need a ride, he needed ammunition. So I think what we have seen over the past near year now is a tremendous pushback by the Ukrainians, real disastrous campaign led by the Russians. And also one other thing I would add is what's striking has been the unity of the United States with our allies, where we have imposed unprecedented sanctions against Russia and the Putin regime, where we have built up our military presence in NATO countries bordering Ukraine, and where we have provided significant assistance to Ukraine to help it win this war.
Both sides at this point have incurred very heavy casualties, including thousands of civilian deaths in Ukraine. But the overall population of Russia is like 100 million people larger than Ukraine, which would imply Russia can keep adding to its military force for much longer than Ukraine, even as deaths and non-fatal injuries mount. What do we know about that?
Yes. So just to put this in perspective for your listeners, Russia has a population of around 140 or 141 million people. Ukraine's population is around 40 to 41 million people. We have seen thousands killed in Ukraine, tragically, as a result of this unprovoked and unjustified invasion. We have seen somewhere between 5 to 7 million Ukrainians flee their country to neighboring states. Some Ukrainians, in fact, have come to the United States and even into the Dallas area. But we have also seen an exodus from Russia, particularly after President Putin announced his mobilization order last September. There was an estimate of possibly as many as 1 million Russians have left since the start of the war, but in particular after Putin announced the mobilization campaign. And while the mobilization officially registered some 300,000 new troops, I think that number is inflated. There is a limit, I think, to how many Russians will sign up to this campaign. Maybe sign up is not the right word, get forced into it. But we have also heard estimates from Western officials suggesting that some 200,000 Russian forces have been killed or wounded in this war. That is actually a little more than what Russia started out with when it invaded Ukraine in the first place. And while there's been a mass of Russian soldiers being sent to the front lines, the Ukrainians are handling this quite well. And so there are many Russians who are being treated as cannon fodder by their leaders, by Putin in particular. He doesn't care what happens to them. But at some point, there is the possibility that Russians will decide, this is senseless, this is pointless, we're getting killed for no reason, and enough is enough.
Well, Britain's defense secretary estimated this week that 97% of what remains of the Russian army is currently in Ukraine. U.S. leaders have put that figure closer to 80%. If the British estimate were true, or closer to true, it does seem to leave Russia in an exceptionally vulnerable position with regard to any other outside threats other than Ukraine, doesn't it?
For sure. And they have had to pull forces back from other positions in order to beef up the presence in Ukraine. And there have also been estimates that the Wagner mercenary forces, and this is in addition to the Russian military, that numbered something like 50,000, that 40,000 of those troops, those forces, had been killed, wounded, surrendered, or captured. So the Wagner mercenaries are taking a beating in this war. I think there's no question that the Russian forces have been terribly led by their generals, by their top military officials. They have suffered from tremendous corruption, which undermined the efforts by Russian leaders to modernize the military, particularly after Russia invaded Georgia, going back as far as 2008. And I think we have also seen a situation where the Russian military doesn't really know why it's there. Putin famously wrote a long article in July of 2021, in which he described Russia and Ukraine as one of the same people. And so I think a lot of Russians are wondering, why are we fighting and killing people who Putin has said are one and the same? And the other thing I'd just add, Chris, is that the Russian forces are using up a lot of their weapons. The Ukrainians are too, for sure, and causing some strains for us in the West who have been providing assistance to them. But the Russians are relying on Iran for drones and other weapons, possibly North Korea as well. And when you have to rely on Iran and North Korea for military assistance, that's not a recipe for success. The Wagner mercenaries also went into Russian prisons to beef up their forces. And they have announced that they've stopped doing that because the Russian prisoners have heard what's happening to them. They're being slaughtered on the front lines. So they are going to have, I think, a problem recruiting. And I don't know that Putin will announce a second mobilization. There's some rumors he might next week. In some respects, he hasn't ended the first one. And but at the end of the day, I think there are a lot of Russians who will say, why should I go fight in this war?
The Bush Center's report on this says U.S. support of Ukraine is vital to our national security interests. I think we all understand this in a broad sense, but can you tell us specifically how that might play out?
Sure. So this is the worst security crisis on the European continent since World War II. And let's remember that Europe was the source of two world wars in the last century. This is an egregious violation of Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, a forcible takeover of Ukrainian territory. And Putin tried to dethrone President Zelensky, the leader of Ukraine, who is a democratically duly elected leader in Ukraine, elected in 2019. And what we have seen is that if Putin were to succeed, and I think now we are at a point where he is not going to succeed, but if Putin were to have succeeded in Ukraine, then he might have been emboldened to think that he could then try Moldova, which is just south of Ukraine, a country of about 3 million people that is formerly part of the Soviet Union, neither a member of the EU nor NATO, just like Ukraine is in neither organization. We might see him feel even more emboldened and try his luck against a NATO member state, particularly the three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And if that were the case, then the NATO alliance would face a serious test on whether they would live up to Article 5 in the NATO Charter, which says that an attack on one state is considered an attack on all. And the United States would then be likely in a much more difficult position of having to decide whether to come to a Baltic nation's defense in the face of a Russian invasion. As it is, we have been providing significant military assistance to Ukraine, and it is important to note that we have not sent troops there because they're not asking us to send our soldiers to fight this fight for them. They are asking for our military assistance so that they can push back on the invading and occupying Russian forces. There's also the factor of how other countries are going to view this. President Xi in China is paying very close attention to how the international community and Europe and the United States in particular respond to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And by showing the sanctions that we've imposed, by showing the determination to support and help Ukraine, I think President Xi might think twice before deciding whether to move against Taiwan. The Iranian leadership is also watching this. The world is watching this. But there are also additional global implications where Russia imposed an embargo on Ukrainian food and agricultural exports that led to a brief global food crisis. It contributed to inflation. All of us wound up paying higher prices when we would go fill up our cars with gas. So this is not a local conflict. It's not something just on the European continent. It has global implications, and that's why it's in our interest to support Ukraine and to help it win.
David, one key recommendation here is that the U.S. and its allies need to increase military support to Ukraine. What could we be doing that is not already happening?
There's the issue of what are called ATACMS, which are long-range artillery that can reach beyond the Russian front lines. The Ukrainians have been asking these for quite a while. We have been resistant because we're worried that they could be used to attack Russian forces inside Russia itself. We had a similar debate when Ukraine asked for what are called HIMARS, which are a similar weapon system but with a shorter range. And we wound up providing those HIMARS, and they actually had a huge impact on Ukraine's ability to fight. I think we should go ahead and provide these additional weapon systems. We did agree to provide, after considerable hemming and hawing, to provide these Abrams tanks, which then opened up the way for Germany to agree to provide what are called Leopard tanks. They are about 200 to 300 of those that Ukraine would like to receive. And there are a number of countries that have these German tanks, and I think those two would have a significant impact on Ukraine's ability to fight. The other weapon system that has been talked about are F-16s, which are these military aircraft that we have. The Ukrainians really want these planes. There seems to be resistance so far in the Biden administration to go ahead and provide these, again, out of concern that it would be viewed as risking escalation from the Russian side. But the Ukrainians are also asking for more air defense systems. We had agreed to provide a Patriot battery system for that. There are a lot of things that Ukraine needs. And while we have done a lot, and I think the administration deserves a lot of credit for what it has done, there does seem to be an issue where the decision-making process takes too long. And every day that we don't go ahead and move these systems to Ukraine, there are Ukrainians who get wounded or killed. And so it's critically important that we speed up the decision-making process, get these weapon systems to Ukraine as quickly as possible to help them win.
How does it work when the United States provides military support to an ally engaged in an active conflict that the United States is not directly involved in? We want them to use the weapons for sort of this, but not that. Is it possible to really attach strings to that military equipment, or is it like giving your brother-in-law a loan to fix his car? You're hoping that's why he'll use it and how he'll use it, but it could be used for a family trip to Disneyland.
It could. Look, this is all very tricky. And we are in uncharted waters with this. We have not been in a situation like this really since World War II. And so what we are doing is to provide Ukraine with the assistance it needs in order, I would argue, not just to defend itself, but to actually win. And we have seen Ukraine regain significant parts of its territory that Russia had occupied going back to February 24. The big question will be whether Ukraine can regain control over territory that Russia occupied when it first invaded Ukraine. We have to keep in mind that this is not the first time Russia has invaded Ukraine. It did so the first time in 2014 when it launched an illegal annexation of Crimea, which is this peninsula area in the Black Sea, and then went into the region called the Donbass, which includes Donetsk and Luhansk in the eastern part of Ukraine. So Russia has had control over those two areas since 2014. By the way, more than 14,000 Ukrainians were killed since Russia invaded in 2014. Many more tragically have died since February 24th last year with the much bigger invasion by Russia. But what we try to do is to get those weapon systems into the Ukrainians' hands as quickly as possible. They often need to be trained on these new systems. When there were Soviet-era weapon systems that Ukraine was receiving, they had experience with those. And on the tanks, for example, it would be very helpful to the Ukrainians if the Germans and others who have these Leopard tanks sent several hundred to them so that the Ukrainians only had to learn how to use one tank system and not a different array of tanks. So there's a lot we can do, and we have had a huge impact on the battle. But as President Biden has said, we don't want a direct confrontation with Russia. And so far, we have been able to walk that fine line.
Well, to your point earlier that Ukraine has not made a request for U.S. troop support, are they not asking because they know the answer would be no?
We have said we're not going to send forces, and they have said they're not going to ask for forces. Now, there have been a number of Americans who actually have gone over to fight on the Ukrainian side. There have been some Americans, tragically, who have been killed in this war. Pete Reed was a recent casualty of this. He was there to provide assistance to Ukraine. But those are volunteers going on their own. We have not provided any forces on the ground except for those who need to train, and most of the training is occurring outside of Ukraine, whether it's in Poland or Germany. Even some training is being conducted here in the United States for Ukrainians. So it's not a matter of having U.S. forces go there, but there is a need for more weapons. The Ukrainians have been going through a lot of the artillery and the bullets and other things. That is drawing down our own supplies of weapons, and so there is a push to accelerate the production within our own countries, and by that I mean both the United States and European countries, in order to make sure we maintain our necessary stockpiles while also providing Ukraine with the assistance that it needs.
Another primary recommendation here is that the U.S. and EU nations maintain and potentially increase sanctions on the Putin regime. What form of those sanctions tends to be most effective?
I think when we apply sectoral sanctions, those would be most important. And that means including all Russian banks, all Russian energy companies, essentially the entire Russian economy. And we have done a good job. As I mentioned before, the sanctions that were imposed almost immediately after the Russian invasion last February have been unprecedented in their scale and in the speed with which they were imposed. But there are loopholes we need to close. We could also impose secondary sanctions, which would impose costs on other countries, third parties, if you will, that might try to help Russia evade the sanctions. So there are ways of making life more difficult. The sanctions, analysts have noted, have not had the impact that was sought on the overall Russian economy. But there have also been export controls, which means that we have limited what is allowed to be exported to Russia so that Russia can't use those in order to beef up its military production. There is one other element to this, Chris, and that is that the Russian Central Bank made a really stupid mistake in leaving half of its hard currency reserves in Western financial institutions. Some $300 billion sits in Japanese, European, American banks. And as we've argued in this policy brief, we believe that they should, that the West, the international community, should not just freeze these assets, which we have already done, but should actually seize these assets, which means that Russia would never get this $300 billion back, and instead it would go toward the reconstruction of Ukraine. We've done this with the assets of Russian oligarchs. Now we need to take the next step and do it with Russian hard currency reserves. Oligarchs, we've frozen about $30 billion worth, but we're talking about $300 billion in hard currency reserves, and that would have a huge impact.
I'm really glad you brought this up, David, because it has baffled me that the Russian government and Russian oligarchs had left, you know, so much of their money stashed in places where it would be vulnerable to sanctions and to seizures by the international community. Did they just not think, after we didn't do quite so much when Russia went after Georgia and later Crimea, that we would take such strong actions?
I think that's part of it, Chris. I think the decision to invade last year was held in a very close circle. Not many people beyond Putin and the very top Russian military leadership, Valery Gerasimov, who's been appointed in charge of the overall war effort. And I think it was also just a brazenness. They didn't think we would respond the way we did. And as we said at the outset of the program, there was a real mis underestimation of the Western response to this. And the central bank head, Nebulina, on the one hand, has been credited for the way she's navigated the sanctions. But on the other hand, she bears real responsibility for leaving these assets so vulnerable in the West. As for the oligarchs, they have lived the high life in many of these countries, including here in the United States. And it has been long overdue to crack down on their corrupt behavior and their exploitation of our openness and our readiness to receive these kinds of assets in our own countries. This enabling behavior that I think is so corrosive, and it helps the Russians with their corruption. Russian corruption is their biggest export, but in order to export it, we import it, and so we need to do a better job of cleaning up our own house as well.
Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has said that one outcome he thinks is off the table is this conflict ending in any kind of stalemate. Does this imply that there is no face-saving option for Putin to withdraw now that he has set his sights on control of so much Ukrainian territory?
Well, I think there are several scenarios here. I think one is that if we continue to provide the assistance that Ukraine needs, that it could win. What does win mean? Win is defined, in my book at least, as Ukraine's ability to drive every Russian troop off of its territory. And I think that is possible if we continue to provide Ukraine the necessary assistance. I think another scenario is a Russian military collapse, where with if that number of 200,000 killed and wounded on the Russian side is true, at some point the Russian military may just break. And as you cited the other report from the UK, that 97% of the Russian army has been mobilized in this conflict, there isn't a lot of give there. And so I think a collapse, which would mean basically Russian soldiers essentially giving up, is a possibility. I think the other part of this that we have to keep in mind, Putin, at the same time that he's been invading Ukraine, has been imposing a near totalitarian system inside Russia. He has total monopoly over the media. Any criticism of the war, which Russians are not supposed to call a war, they're supposed to call it a special military operation, he snuffs out immediately. And so, with his control over the domestic situation, even a withdrawal, even a situation where he loses Crimea, he may be able to paint as a victory. But it also could produce a real turmoil politically in Russia and lead to some change. We don't know. I don't think it's our business to find Putin an off-ramp. He created this mess, and it's up to him to find a way out. Or it's, I think, more importantly, we need to maintain our focus in helping Ukraine win, and the rest of this will sort of fall into place.
David, Ukraine obviously needs material and financial support to keep fighting. It will also need resources to rebuild and survive as a democracy. What does this report suggest as a role for international lending agencies?
Well, as we touched on before the break, Chris, I think the issue of Russian hard currency reserves is one way to fund this reconstruction. Ukraine is likely going to need possibly half a trillion to $1 trillion. If you just look at the pictures, you can understand the tremendous devastation caused by Russia's bombing of Ukrainian infrastructure, its energy supplies, apartment buildings, other things. And so Ukraine will need lots and lots of assistance. The International Monetary Fund will have an important role to play here. The World Bank will have an important role to play. The Europeans have an important role to play. We have been the leading supporter of providing Ukraine with military assistance, and we have provided a significant sum of that assistance, thanks to the generosity of the American people and bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress. as well as with the administration, despite some voices you hear that we should be focusing on other things. But I think the main source of some of this funding, excuse me, will come from the Russian hard currency reserves if we move ahead from freezing to seizing these assets. Russia should be paying a significant part of the reconstruction of Ukraine, given that it is Russia that has caused the damage in the first place. So I think that's the role that we can play here, going after those assets and encouraging the international lending agencies to step up and play their role too.
What's involved, generally speaking, in funneling money from Russian hard currency reserves to organizations like the IMF that might dole out some financial aid to Ukraine?
It would likely be more where the funds from the hard currency reserves would be devoted to a specific fund, a new fund that would be created for Ukrainian reconstruction. The IMF and the World Bank would have their own pots of money that they can dip into to provide support to Ukraine. But what I think would be needed would be to set up a standalone fund, if you will, in which these the revenue from the hard currency reserves that would be seized could be provided. There have been anti-corruption activists in Ukraine who have encouraged that most of the money not necessarily go through the Ukrainian government. Ukraine has had a history of problems with corruption, though President Zelensky, just in the past few weeks, has underscored his determination to go after any corrupt activity, dismissing a number of Ukrainian officials, and also arresting some people who have been engaged or alleged to have engaged in corrupt activity. I think with Ukraine today, among the population, there is close to zero tolerance for corrupt behavior. And with the Ukrainians having been injured and killed in so many numbers, Ukrainians aren't going to tolerate Ukrainian oligarchs or anyone else in official positions to siphon off these funds. But the main thing is to help Ukraine establish these funds and move ahead with this. There have been some who were concerned that if we went after the hard currency reserves, that would scare off China or others who also place a lot of their money in our accounts. My reaction to that is if China were to invade Taiwan, I'd freeze and seize China's assets as well. Putting their assets in our banks, Western banks, that is, should not give countries a pass in not paying a price for things they do, like the invasion of Ukraine.
Okay, what about the timing of this? Does it make sense to start that flow of financial aid to Ukraine now while the country is still actively sustaining damage to infrastructure, or to hold off until either the fighting has ended or the situation has at least stabilized in some way?
Humanitarian assistance, of course, is needed yesterday, and we have been providing that. There has been significant humanitarian assistance that has gone into Ukraine to help treat the injured, to help evacuate Ukrainians from places where they need, and to help rebuild in some places where at least the fighting seems to have subsided. But I think the larger package for reconstruction of Ukraine is something that will have to come mostly after the fighting ends. But there will be parts of the country that will have been affected by the war that will no longer be the main targets of Russian bombing. And I think helping those areas first will be needed. Parts of Ukraine are just being wiped out. We've seen the pictures from places like Bucha and Mariupol and other cities and towns in Ukraine. And Russia is essentially taking a position of leveling these places. Accusations of war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide by Russian forces, I think, are very well founded. It's not the first time, by the way, Russia has engaged in this kind of activity. You look at how they leveled Aleppo in Syria. You look at what they did to their own city, Grozny, the capital of Chechnya and the southern part of Russia. This, unfortunately, is consistent with Russian behavior. So we also need to make sure that there is accountability for these war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide, along with providing the assistance that Ukraine will need to rebuild. I think we also need to help Ukraine move ahead and join the European Union and NATO. That arguably would be one of the greatest repudiations of Putin's effort to maintain control over Ukraine.
Well, given Vladimir Putin's general paranoia about the expansion of NATO and the extent to which his aggression in Ukraine may have been an attempt to forestall this, it does seem ironic that the invasion has catalyzed the organization's invitations of membership to places like Finland and Sweden and applications by other countries. Is it fair to say Putin's desire to limit the scope of NATO may have made the alliance stronger?
I think so, Chris. I mean, I think, as you rightly pointed out, instead of seeing NATO pull back, it actually is going to enlarge. Once we get Turkey on board with Sweden, Finland looks like it will move ahead, and they may move on a separate track. Turkey has posed some obstacles for Swedish membership. But Ukraine, there is strong support among Ukrainians for joining NATO. It is important to remember, however, that when Putin first invaded Ukraine in 2014, NATO was not the issue. What Ukraine was planning to do in 2013, the fall before the invasion, was to sign agreements with the European Union. Ukraine had already passed legislation under the pro-Russian president at the time, Viktor Yanukovych, that made Ukraine a non-aligned state. And it was not seeking NATO membership after it was promised NATO membership in 2008 by NATO. So NATO was not the driving force behind the invasion in 2014. I don't think it was the driving force in last year's decision to invade. Putin just wants to essentially control Ukraine, doesn't view it as an independent state, rejects the notion that it has a right to determine its own future. And NATO has risen to the challenge. And clearly, Ukrainians want to join NATO so that they would have Article 5 security guarantees in the future. And it seems to me, in light of how Ukraine has done so well in fighting Russia with its experience in doing so, NATO at this point would be lucky to have Ukraine.
Are you willing, David, to make any sort of prediction about the next year of this conflict? Like, what is the best case scenario if you and I sit down once again 12 months from now?
I hope in that case, Chris, that we would be talking about Ukrainian victory in the past and that we would be talking about Ukraine's reconstruction, its pursuit of membership in the European Union and in NATO. That would be the best case scenario. I think if the United States and our allies continue on a faster pace, provide the assistance Ukraine needs, Ukraine can win this war. Ukrainians have shown a tremendous determination to fight. There is huge support among Ukrainians to continue this battle. They think they can win. They reject any territorial concessions or compromise. They reject negotiations with Putin. I think they rightly don't believe any paper that Putin would sign for a ceasefire. And they are determined to win this war. And I think they can as long as we provide them with the assistance they need. So I think there is an optimistic scenario here that is not far-fetched, that is not Pollyannish or naive. I think the Ukrainians can win. They are doing a lot better than most analysts predicted a year ago. And this war has not gone the way that either Putin or others in the Kremlin or the Russian military anticipated.
David J. Kramer is executive director of the George W. Bush Institute. You can find the organization's recommendations for U.S. support of Ukraine online at bushcenter.org. David, thanks very much for making time to talk us through this.
It's been my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.